Yeah, welcome everybody. Awesome turnout. Glad to see everybody for round three of Talking Some Turkey here, preseason, Mississippi turkey season at the marvelous Rick's Cafe. I don't think there's anywhere else we'd rather press this little REC button right here for the 100th time for the Spring Legion podcast and right here in a town that means a lot to all of us up here. Really appreciate y'all coming out and all the support and everything, and want to really send our appreciation to Rick's for hosting us and letting us come out here and hang out with y'all, talk a little turkey. Thank ONX and Open Season for providing some really good co-hosts up here, because it'd be pretty boring if it was just me up here. And I'm Hunter Ferry, I'm the founder of Spring Legion, and alongside Chase Ferry, my brother, and Austin Seals, if y'all listen to the podcast, y'all are up to date on who these jokers are. As if y'all keep up with us, you know we're pretty good buddies with these two fine gentlemen down here, Lake and Jordan. So Lake's going to give a little spill on who
they are. So I'm Lake. I work for ONX. Been with ONX for 2 years now. I think when we first started this thing, I was still doing primos all the time. But, yeah, it's fun to be up here for a third year in a row. This has become a really fun thing that we've gotten to do. And just to have y'all come out and – for the sake of talking about turkeys for a little while is fun enough for me. And then if y'all are familiar with Jordan, I'll let him talk more about himself. But how long do we work at Primos together? Like six
or 7 years. And yeah. Jordan Blissett, used to work with Lake at Primos, like he said, and full-time working at Open Season Properties and doing land management stuff on the side as well. So kind of made a transition in the last couple of years into the real estate world, and we've all still became or still stayed buddies and friends and all love to turkey hunt together. So appreciate you having y'all out here tonight.
Got one more turkey hunter that y'all might be familiar with. Want to introduce real quick. He's going to come up to the stage and steal Jordan's mic. He is an avid outdoorsman and turkey hunter from Columbia, Mississippi, I think, and down south. And he is currently has been stolen down to Florida for a few years because he's a starting punter for the Jacksonville Jaguars. A good godly man, a salt of the earth kind of guy, and we're all very proud to call him our friend. Mr. Logan Cook's here, and he is going to also forgot to mention he's a Mississippi State alum. He's a Bulldog. That's the most important thing. But he's going to give us a little spill on a little project he's got going, and one that we wholeheartedly support, and hope that after y'all get a little listen on what he's got going over here with his mission, y'all will as well.
Yeah, appreciate Hunter and Austin and everyone else here having me. Took a minute to get this mic on, but we got it figured out. But no, we have this is the first year the Logan Cook Foundation has been going. We started it back in October, and it's just something. I mean, I feel like a lot of us had the same passions and the same things we want to be involved with, and this is kind of something that you might want to be involved with. We have our first banquet. It's coming up Friday here in a couple of days down in Brandon, Mississippi at McLean Lodge, and we have a ton of raffle items. We have guns, bows, hunting trips, fishing trips, Jaguars game day experiences if you're passionate about the NFL. We have a Dak jersey, so for all the Mississippi State fans, and the Logan Cook Foundation started. This is going into my seventh season in the NFL, and me and my wife kind of, after the first couple of years, kind of figured out that we wanted to do more. We kind of wanted to use our platform for something more beneficial than what we were doing, and so we decided to start our own foundation. And this year, 2024, all the proceeds that we raise through the Logan Cook Foundation will go 100% towards Zoe Ministries, who's an organization we've partnered with the past 3 years now, funding water wells in Kenya, right there on the Kenya-Uganda border. And we're actually going to visit some of those locations this June. And it's just something cool. If you're a passionate hunter, fisherman, love football, there's a lot of cool prizes, a lot of possible opportunities for you to have some cool trips. And I think it'd be a cool thing for you to be a part of and give back to a good cause. I appreciate it. If you want to make it down there, you can buy tickets at the Logan Cook Foundation com, and or come talk to me after. I'll be sitting over here in the corner. And but yeah, appreciate your time and love to see you there. Thanks, guys.
All right. Well, yeah, we hope to see y'all there. We'll all be there at the banquet there at McLean in a couple of days. And I guess it's about time we'll kick off with a couple stories before kind of jumping in a few questions and some live Q&A and giveaways and all the good stuff that y'all are probably really here for. But I'll kick it off with a story I don't think I've told. Lake might have one to follow in. I'm sure he does. You get a storytelling.
Yeah, I'm good to go. Just tell me when.
Well, hopefully I ain't going to get rambling too long, but I was thinking about on the drive up here coming up 25, and I'm a familiar drive for years of my life, at least five of them. But but I was thinking about kind of turkey hunting around Starville, and if y'all read the book or anything like that, you know that I kind of cut my teeth on public land turkey hunting around here in the northern part of the state, and along with that came myself getting those teeth kicked in by some public land turkeys in the remote area right around this this little junction here. And learned a lot that year, a new appreciation for the wild turkey and those who hunt them as well. It's a truly different culture down here, and especially we kind of dabble into some of the public land. It's a different beast. I don't care what anybody says. And it was new to me when I was up in college. I was kind of just by a product of elimination. I had to go figure it out and learned a lot, like I said. But the story I'm going to tell was kind of the following year. I'd yet to, I think, hear a turkey gobble on public land. And for some reason, I don't know why. It sounds a little bit crazy, but to come back up here on opening weekend to try it again. But I was up here, obviously going to school here at Mississippi State, and I was bound and determined to figure out these woods that had I can't really explain any better than I felt like I was hunting ghosts for a whole year. I don't know how many times I went hunting without hearing one, but I did. And I kept going, and it really got under my skin. And so I spent the in-between times of May and March studying this area as much as I could and figuring out how to get into a bunch of areas where I would think other turkey hunters wouldn't be as willing to go. And found a pretty good little bottom, real open, looked like turkey woods to me. And about February 2nd, started going to listen for turkeys, and I listened, I think, all 28 days of February, and hadn't really heard anything. And then I want to say it was on the 19th of February. I remember this because it was Austin's birthday, and it was I was out there. I was kind of, had my back against the hood of my truck and my green leaf jacket on, just propped up around, general gobbling time. I would say, would that be 6:15 maybe? Something like that. It's a breaking day. Well, every other time I listen for gobbles, it's about a good time for that. And I'm sitting there, and I see some headlights coming down the gravel road, and a big old cloud of dust kind of comes up to me, and the dust settles, and it's a Dodge Durango. And it's still pretty dark, and I can tell the gentleman driving it was rolling down his window and, kind of waved the dust out of my face and kind of peeked in, and I could tell he flipped on his, truck cab light. And he just kind of stares at me, and neither of us really say a word for a second. He just says, too late. And I was like, okay. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what he was talking about. I'm thinking, how in the world does this old man know that I'm even out here listening for turkeys? How does he know that I haven't heard one? And sure as heck, how does he know the turkey that I hadn't heard gobble has already gobbled? Because he hadn't driven down here while I was standing here. And I don't think nothing of him. You're in those kind of situations, you don't really ask questions. You just say, yes, sir. And I kind of went on about my business. How did he? For some reason, I think his name was John. I don't know. But I was thinking about it for a while. I'm like, I know I've thought about this before. He either told me his name or I made it up. I don't know. But I think his name is Mr. John. And I kind of come to gather that he lived down that road. He wasn't out there listening for turkeys or anything. So I'd seen him, a couple times, or a Durango a couple times. And so I figured, he must have been a local, had a house down there, something like that. And for all I know, I guess he was talking about turkeys, but he never really explained much before he kind of put it back in drive and carried on. Fast forward to March, I want to say it was March 15th. It might have been a day after opening day, but I think I drove up from kind of our hometown of Raymond. Left real early, got up there, kind of the same area, I'd say. I don't I don't really remember where I parked or anything like that, but I was sitting there and got out. I got there about, 4:30 or so, because keep in mind, I still ain't really heard a turkey gobble in this place, and I'd just driven multiple hours to come hunt something that I don't know is there, and I'm getting the early mixture. Nobody beats me to this spot that, for all I know, nobody wants to be at the spot anyways, and I'm outside getting stuff together, and, you know, the owls are cutting up, and some of the, you know, the usual nighttime choir of nature is kind of going on about itself, and it's funny because it was just a split second of just silence for a second. I hear a pow, just a quick one out to my left, and I'm thinking, I wouldn't say it was a gobble, but it was enough to, you know, raise my eyebrow, kind of raise the ear up, and I think on it just for a second, and I kind of sit back. I'm like, nah, it wasn't nothing. Get back to get my stuff together, and I'll be dang if I didn't hear another. It was pow. And I'm sitting there. I'm like, okay. I start really getting my stuff together at this point. And keep in mind, it ain't even 5 o'clock yet, and I'm putting my vest on, get my gun and stuff, and I'm thinking, you know, my best option is to kind of head down this little gully coming off the side of the road, and as another ridge comes up, and so I head down and come up, and thinking if nothing else, I can get up there and either confirm it is or isn't, if it's a dog or something. I got enough time to get back to the road and hear the other side or get where I was going anyways, and. I grab my gun, get down in there, and hop back up on this other ridge, and sure enough, I hear a pew. I'm like, that's a gobble. I know that's a gobble. And I look back. I don't even know if I shut the door on my truck, but, you know, this is first time in 30-something tries I'd heard a gobble out here. And so I take off, and I swear it took me 10 minutes to cover half a mile because I don't even think I looked down. I'd just been so familiar with this ground. I knew where every down log crossed every creek and all this good stuff, where every little – pig trail went through the thickets and stuff, and there's path of least resistance to get there. And if I'm lying down, I'm sitting there 100 yards from this turkey, and he is, you know, lighting the woods on fire 100 yards from me now with my back against the tree, kind of thinking, what in the world, you know? And if it is a minute past 5:15, it's high noon, and it is pitch black dark out there, and that turkey just gobbles and gobbles and gobbles and gobbles until about 5:45 or so, 6 o'clock. He just he gets cold, and I'm thinking, you know, you start running through them scenarios. You're like, what's happened? Somebody else had bumped him off the limb. I know he didn't see me because I sat down, and he gobbled 55 times after I sat down. You know, I wasn't even thinking about doing any kind of calling or anything like that, but I'm thinking somebody didn't come in from the backside and bumped him off the limb or something. Do I get up and head on out? And by that time, I got to thinking about that old man who stopped me a month ago. He said, you're too late. I'm like, that had to have been what he was talking about. He knew about this turkey. I had no idea at the time this guy had a turkey hunter or anything. He never mentioned it, really. But I got to sit in there thinking, like, I guarantee. And so I sat there and, you know, just kind of like just trusting my gut that guy, that's exactly what he was talking about, that I was too late listening that morning. And because obviously he'd seen me park there multiple times, and he's probably shaking his head going to work or coming home from work, working a night shift or something, going, that boy, you know, he ain't going to hear that turkey showing up at 6 o'clock like that. And sure enough, that turkey gobbled about he was on the ground next time he gobbled. I think I remember correctly, I waited until about I could start hearing some, you know, tires popping behind me and stuff like that. It started breaking daylight a little bit. It'd be an early fly down, but it was enough to make a little sense. Did a fly down and a couple tree yelps. And sure enough, he gobbled. He got on the ground. I heard some wings, I'd say. Not long after that, and he gobbled about 150 yards in front of me. And I'm telling you, to this day, probably among the prettiest things I've seen in turkey woods. I don't get to see this often. I mean, I'm just talking chalk white head of a gobbler strutting through this open bottom down here, sifting in the hallway. And it took him, I swear, 2 hours to get to the tree I was on. But from 150 to 20 yards, I got there staring him in the eye, and it made everything worth it. Made everything, all the humblings that I'd been through at that point, you know, learning how to turkey hunt on public land, a lot more worth it. And I ain't gonna say that happened anymore after that. But if I had to go through a season or season and a half of doing that again, I would in a heartbeat. But that's one I don't think I've ever really told or ever really elaborated on. And it just happened to kind of connect to our time spent up here. And I know Lake's got several around this part, but I'll let you just kind of mosey on into.
I don't know. It sounded like a good one. Yeah, can y'all hear me okay? Good. We're good to go. So in the nature of Hunter telling the story of his first turkey up here, I thought I would fall into a similar vein. And when I went to school up here, it'll make me sound old saying this, but I was up here, it was like 2012, I think. And I remember not being too worried about the public land turkey situation, because I was like, man, public land turkeys is kind of what I do a lot at home. That's what I started out at. And so then first time that I went out here and hunted, I just tell the story. I'd gone out there and scouted, and I found a turkey. And for some reason in my young, naive mind, I was like, I'm the only one that knows about this turkey, which was false. And so I go out there opening day, and not by any strategy or me really knowing what was going on, but I somehow, in the dark, sit down at this tree, and the turkey starts gobbling on the limb, and he's about 100, 120 right here. And then as the day breaks and I start hearing some clucking and yelping, I realize that there's a flock of hens like 40 yards right here. So I'm like, man, I am in the driver's seat, you know? And so they start yelping, these turkeys starts gobbling. It's early season in Mississippi. There's virtually no foliage on the tree, so you can see really well. I see these hens start pitching down, and there's like five of them. And they pitch down, and before I know it, they're like 45 yards directly behind me, and these turkeys are gobbling. And I kind of saw a bit of a turkey right here pitch down, but they had to go down into a bottom and then pop up to the ridge I was on. And I hadn't even called yet. I was like, man, they're gonna come right here. This is perfect. They get down at bottom, the gobbling gets closer, and you can tell it's a group of them as early season offens end up. And I'm just sitting there waiting on them, and all of a sudden, whoom! And I see turkeys fly off, and next thing I know, I see a guy come walking out toting a turkey. And that was my first experience on public land up here. And the rest of the season was about more of the same. I killed turkeys that year, but I didn't kill them on any public. I got royally butt-whipped. And so I realized I had to kind of tune in my tactics a little bit. And so second spring up here rolls around, and a very good friend of mine had told me that, you know, it would be probably a good idea. He said, hunt odd hours, which to my young mind, I was like, odd hours, you know, what do you mean? And it's, you know, the classic, you know, everybody gets out there and hunts daybreak and hunts till about 9:30, and then they got class to go to or something, and then they bail, they're gone. Well, one morning, I was in soils class, and my first cousin, Tanner Clanton, was in the same class with me. And we get out of class, and it's like 8:30, 9 o'clock, and we're talking. I said, I got a lab I got to go to at 1, and this, that, and Tanner's got a class at whenever. And I just, on a whim, I look at him, I say, you want to go hunt a turkey? And he's like, where at? I said, well, there's a spot where I've been finding them in the mornings. Let's go in there. He's like, okay. So we load up, run to the Highlands, run to my house, get my stuff. He gets his stuff, and we take off. And we walk in there and just sit down. And This next part of this story contains two events, one of which is very uncharacteristic of me, and one is very characteristic of me, if you know my history of shooting at turkeys. It's tumultuous. But we sit there, and we yelp and call every 10 minutes like you're supposed to and whatever, and hadn't heard anything, and finally we make the decision. I said, if we don't hear anything or get into anything – by, I think we said, like 11 o'clock or 12, something like that. It's like, we've got to get out of here. You know, it's like, because we're not into anything, I don't need to miss this lab. Well, I just dig through my mouth call pouch, and I pick out this mouth call, and with no sense of being serious at all, just me being me, I go, this here's the secret weapon. And I pop that call in my mouth, and I, like, cluck four times and yelp a couple notes, and Tanner looks at me. And like somehow he thought I knew that was going to happen, and I was like, you bet. And we struck that turkey, and at that point, the idea of me making that lab just went out of my mind. And that was the, you know, me striking that turkey, calling my shot like that, that was the part of the story that was not characteristic of me. That doesn't happen. But I think that it was two of them, and I think they gobbled three or four more times, and they didn't just come charging in by any stretch of the imagination, but they were just constantly gaining ground. And for a little while, we, you know, went quiet, and it had been a couple minutes, I don't know how long it was in actuality, but it'd been a couple minutes where nothing had happened. I had stopped calling, the turkeys had stopped gobbling, and I couldn't stand it anymore. And so I decided I'm going to yelp, just soft. And I start yelping, and then, like, as I'm yelping, I still see Tanner sitting there through his face mask. And I yelp, like, two notes, and I just see Tanner's eyes just get real big, and I just stop. And as soon as I stop yelping, I can hear him walking. I mean, there was a little bit of a rise, and I just kind of sink down into my gun. And I just remember these two full fans just cresting that ridge. And I'm like, those turkeys couldn't push their head back any further into their feathers if they tried to. They just, you know. And I'm, for a second there, and this is the part of the story that's very characteristic of me. This is very much within my wheelhouse. I got lost in the sauce for quite a while. I'm just sitting there looking at them. And finally, I'm like, oh, yeah, I need to shoot one of these. And they're like 20 yards, just strutting, drumming, and, you know, doing the thing. And if you were to ask me, Lake, where's your bead at? I would say, I don't know, but I'm going to pull this trigger. And so, and they were right on the edge of this ridge, and I shot, and the turkey, that one turkey flew straight up in there. And the turkey that I shot at just kind of disappeared on the other side of the ridge. And also, me being me, I only had two shells on me that day, and I'd done spent one of them. And so the turkey that I shot at kind of disappears over the ridge, and I don't know if I shot him or what. And I stand up and go to running. And when I top that ridge, I realize that turkey's running too. And that's the part that's characteristic of me. And so thing number one, pay attention to where you're aiming. The head is where you want to go. Thing number two, don't run with the shotgun. But I did that day. And I take off running. And my shotgun's over my back. And this turkey is obviously hit to some degree because I've almost caught up to him and I'm not what you would say speedy. And so I'm sitting here sprinting after this turkey to the point where I think I'm close enough to grab him. And then I'm thinking, you idiot, you have a shotgun. So I stop and pull a gun and shoot him. And then I got the turkey and just fell out on the ground. And I remember holding the turkey in this hand, my shotgun in this hand, and I was just looking up like this. And I remember Tanner coming and looking over me being like, dude, you okay? Because I was just laying there just, but that was my first turkey up here. Yeah, it was eventful. That's how most of my turkey stories go. Jordan can attest to that.
I've seen the same thing play out a few times since then.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was my first rodeo up here.
I don't know if we all got into telling stories. I think we would be here till 11 o'clock, and I know y'all want to hear what y'all have requested. And we kind of put a little thing on our social media stuff. If some of y'all might be here today, who submitted some of these questions, topics, or points to hit while we're up here, talk. You know, just turkey hunting is all we're here to do. And we had a couple sent in. I thought it would line well with some of our individual professions a little bit. And the first one, I read it and immediately thought of Mr. Jordan over here because he is the guru. And it said, I own a piece of recreational land and would like to start implementing prescribed burns for a better habitat. What all will I need to begin burning? I guess, and he put like a dash, like permits, equipment, people, you know, steps necessarily.
Well, the first thing is to find somebody that is burning and go watch them a few times. That's first. Also, if you don't have that option, there's a lot of information on YouTube, articles to read about how to get started in prescribed burning or controlled burns, whatever you want to call them. Another option, too, and it's something I did a lot to kind of, I didn't know I was doing it at the time, but it helps me now, is burning your yard off. Burning little corners of your yard just to figure out how fire works, because it's a great thing to use, but it's also dangerous, and it can get out of hand in a heartbeat, and your neighbors won't be too happy if you burn their house down. But I mean, it is what it is. We were on the way up here today, and or this morning, I had a guy call me. He's like, "Hey, you burning such and such part of the Yazoo County?" I was like, "No, I ain't up there today." And he's like, "Well, they done had a fire get out, and it's done burn up over 1,000 acres of land and pickings." And anyway, well, that just shows you, like, today it was a very, it's high pressure, but it was also very unpredictable gust of wind, and fire can do some crazy things with, when the wind gets behind it. But to get started, if you got a little bit of experience behind you, if you somewhat know what you're doing, been doing it a little bit, where you kind of understand how backing fires work, head fires work, and the wind plays accordingly with smoke transfer and whatnot. When you get ready to burn your place, get some lanes pushed around it. If you don't have a bulldozer, go in there with a rake, a leaf blower. Logan and I yesterday were burning. He run two tanks of gas out of his leaf blower trying to get a little lane pushed around, but it worked. Another thing is, when you decide to burn that day, call the Mississippi Forestry Commission, ask for a burn permit. They're going to ask you who's the landowner, who's doing the fire, their phone number. They're going to need the lat and long or address of the fire location, the amount of acres you're planning on burning, what's the purpose of the burn. For most of us, it's going to be wildlife purposes slash timber. And then they'll tell you, okay, you can burn from this time of day to this time of day. And a lot of times they'll give you a weather report if you request it, and they'll kind of help you with that through the phone, like, hey, it's not a really good day to burn, even though we're giving out permits, or give you an idea about that. So there's a lot that goes into it. Weather's a big thing. I mean, fuel load in your forest is huge. If you got a heavy, dense fuel load, and fuel load is the amount of debris, shrubs, whatever is flammable in that timberland. And, you know, the safer fires, I would say, is like a pine stand that doesn't have a bunch of brush growing in it. You're pretty much just burning pine straw. That's probably the best thing to start on if you're just getting started burning, because it's somewhat manageable as long as it's not crazy wind and a lot of fuel in there.
I had a guy that was telling me he was doing it in terms of quail management, but he had a guy burn. It was like a Bahia grass field, which really wasn't of any value to anything because the native seed bank wasn't there, but it was just so the guy could get comfortable with burning.
Mm-hmm.
Because one thing, and you probably could speak to this too, it's here lately, like, burning has become a more popular topic, which is awesome, but then there comes like a, there's a lot of folks that they, well, I guess like the person asked that question, they're like, what do I even start with that? So
And the Mississippi Forestry Association, they have classes you can take and also become a certified prescribed burn manager.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you're going to do it for a somebody else, a living or whatever, I mean, it's worth going to those classes just to learn. And there's also some online classes for kind of prereqs for that you take, and it's pretty helpful too far as learning the kind of the temperament of weather and fire, how they mix.
Mm-hmm. Which, shameless plug, since we're on the topic of burning, like this Saturday up here in Starkville, there's a Game Bird Weekend that's getting put on by the MDWFP and Mississippi State. And I think there's not many tickets left, but there's a few. I think it's like in the single digits. But if you signed up for that, it's like an in-person, you go to a property. I mean, they're going to put a drip torch in your hands, and you're going to get some hands-on education, which what you were talking about, that is – the best way to learn is to go with somebody that knows what they're doing, and there's going to be a lot of folks there that know what they're doing.
Heck yeah. Yeah, I need to take them up on that. But yeah, I told y'all Jordan was a guru.
Yeah. I don't know if y'all noticed, coming up 12 today, it was a lot of smoke.
Yeah.
They burning something good.
It was hard to see coming over some of the meals.
Yeah.
Which is pretty awesome.
Which is good.
You know what's going on.
Yeah. It puts you in the mood, kind of, yeah. To get ready.
It's kind of like we have the NWTF convention, which is kind of the kickoff or whatever. But my switch starts getting a little wobbly around the end of January, although the season starts shutting off, and you start noticing some flowers here and there. And I'm like, all right, goblins are coming and stuff. And, you know, the past couple of years have been a little hectic around NWTF. I was, you know, doing stuff up there instead of just attending like we usually do. But that's kind of the kickoff, and then you kind of come, when you come back, it's almost like that going in spring, you know.
Yeah.
It's time to go listen. You start seeing smoke in the air and folks doing all that good stuff, and it's and then it's here, you know. But let's roll on with them. This one is all right. So Chase,
all right,
you ready?
I guess.
How can I most accurately gauge a gobble when roosting a bird, like in the evening?
In the evening, okay.
Not a roosted bird, but like, you know, if you're going out in the evening to roost one.
All right. I don't roost often, but when I do, there's a few tactics I use. If you hear one, hopefully you have two people. That's my number one cause. If you can have two folks split up, you know, if you got a bend in the road or another, a couple of ridges and stuff in between, I like to send a guy a couple hundred yards down and, you know, hoot, and he knows my hoot, or I know his hoot, and he'll put a line, and I'll put a line, and pretty much where they intersect, you know, if you drop it on X or something like that.
You said drop a pin on the gobble.
Drop on pin.
Where you think.
Yeah, you can use your little compass tool or whatever, yeah. I think, and drop your pin out there about where you think he is, and they'll do one from there. And if you're by yourself, if he's gobbling long enough, which in Mississippi, you know, you're lucky to get two or three out of them if on a good day. But if you can get one from, you know, a couple hundred yards apart, I think where they X is where I like to assume they are. You know, that's one tactic I use. I mean, it's a lot of times in the morning I do that too. I'll hear one and move down until I almost pass him if he's in the woods, mm-hmm. 200 or 300 yards. And then it kind of gives me a gauge of where to shoot in the, mm-hmm. the cut, if that explains anything.
Yeah.
It kind of worked out for us in Alabama last year too.
Yeah.
That we were all three were kind of skirting up and down the road, and all three of us dropped a pin and ended up where the lines intersected was about where me and Chase started, and about where that turkey was.
Yeah, pretty much you draw a triangle on that bird like this. You know, one guy stayed in the triangle, and Hunter walked up this way, and Seals walked up this way, and pretty much, you know, we had three or four different lines going on them, and half, if he gobbled when you're halfway to your destination of however far you want to walk up the road, you drop a pin there too. And I mean, we had like six lines crossing at one particular spot, and it was like he has to be there. Then me and Seals went in there and got under him pretty close that next morning. He just went the other way. You know, it was just one of the things.
This is the time I'm thinking of. I walked like a mile. I swear this turkey had to have been on the ground. I was trying to hear. Because I kept going and kept going and kept going, and it kept going and going and going.
Well, after we got there the next day, we realized why, the way the terrain was.
Oh, yeah.
Because he wasn't moving where me and Chase were.
Yeah.
And you kept going and going, and it was just that funnel that he was gobbling down.
And that is another thing I like to look at is the terrain in there.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if I'm familiar with it, I'll normally know when there's a ridge or something that, you know, 90% of the time they fly off of a ridge or fly into a ridge or both.
Both.
I mean, so – if you know there's a big ridge in there, you can kind of gauge he's on one side or the other. You know, as long as you can judge the foliage on the trees to know how loud he'll be, you know, you can kind of tell a lot of times if he's on that side of the ridge or this side of the ridge, whether you need to come in from this way or come in from this way. And creeks will sometimes give them away.
Yeah, and what makes most sense, if you think he's right here but there's also a creek right there,
he's probably actually over there, and the sound's coming up
going on there, or the highest elevation is a little further than what it seems like. He's probably just up there, and, you know, something's between you and him.
If I can figure out close to where he's at, I don't like pushing right up under him if I can. I just get kind of in that same area or come in from the other side of him, and then I'll know, like, okay, he is still in there, A. B, you know, I came in from the left instead of the right this time, you know, as I was the night before. And, you know, and then I can judge it from where I was standing the other night to here. All right, he sounds about 200 yards, and he sounded about 300 yards from that four-wheeler trailer, whatever it may be. And then I can kind of know where to set up. And I like to stay back about 100 yards from them. That's about as close as I want to get to one.
Yeah.
Just because I bump too many.
Oh, yeah.
And especially when the leaves start getting on the trees, your ears ain't used to it. And First week of
April, you got to really reset everything.
And that was first week of season this year.
Yeah.
This past season.
Yeah, it was the last week in March.
I looked up, and I was under that one opening day, and I was like, I'm too close. Yeah. I mean, I'd bumped one hen already. I was like, I got to sit down.
I think, if I remember correctly, Seals, you got a question that kind of is going to piggyback off of that one. So it says, if you are hunting familiar ground and a gobbler is on the limb, so this is the next morning, roosted or not, I don't guess it matters.
I can cover both of them.
All right.
Because there's two different answers.
Would you rather slip in close or set up in a bottom where you heard him the day before?
So if I know where he's roosted, I'm going to get there early, and I'm going to try to slip in as close to where, kind of like what me and Chase did, as close to where we think he is, and then wait for a gobble before I make my, you know, close more ground. But if I don't know where he is, I just hear him that morning,
and I know the terrain, I'm still going to try to get as close as I can. Mm-hmm. You may not have gotten there as early because you don't know where he's roosting. I'm going to still try to push as close as I can. And it also depends on if it's the first 2 weeks or, it, you know,
the last 2 weeks.
Well, yeah, because you can slip a lot closer once you get the foliage on the tree.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So in that situation, I'm going to try to get as close as I can because even though I think it said even though he was gobbling, and you know where he gobbled yesterday morning, but the chances of him doing the same exact thing are slim. So I'm going to try to get as close to him as I can and at least let him hear me before he flies down. But and especially if I know where he is the night before, the evening before, because when I'm getting there – it's hard to do it when I'm with you, but I'll get in there really early and slip in there and just sit by a tree until he gobbles. But, you know, other than that, I try to get as close. I try to gauge when I'm about 100 yards from him, and then I'll kind of settle down and see what his next move is. But
yeah, and if you can see you can squeeze another 50 yards out of him after he gobbles good, you can move in.
Yeah.
And a quick question off of that was, you know, did he say get in the bottom with him or not?
He meant like,
just get close to him or not?
Well, no. Like, they usually, God, I know I've been in his shoes before.
Right.
You hunt this turkey from every which way, and every single time it seems like he somehow winds up around you and in the same bottom. And you, do I just go sit in the bottom, wait on him?
Except when you end up in the bottom.
Then goes in the bottom, wait on him, and he's not. He won't be on top of the ridge where you were the day before.
A lot of times, you know, if you've got two ridges a good ways apart, you know, that's considered the bottom. A turkey's going to be roosted on a tree that's coming out of that bottom because he flew off one of the side hills and is going to fly into one of the side hills.
Right.
Or if you have, you know, one ridge.
Yeah.
My best chance with that is getting on the other side of that ridge.
If it's one
singular ridge on the right and he's in the bottom roosted somewhere here, I'm going to be set up on this side of that ridge, right over the knoll.
I would like to be.
30 yards. But,
and that's, I call it what you were just talking about, I call them like a point of option, kind of.
Right.
I think turkeys will get to where they can see this ridge and this ridge, or at least hear this ridge and see that ridge, or vice versa, or something like that. I think turkeys like to have the cake and they like to eat it too. They like to roost over water for safety reasons more so than anything. But I think marginally it can be attributed to the way sound carries on, you know, water. They're louder, they can be heard for further distance, and then and also. You know, I don't like walking through creeks as much as a turkey probably doesn't like walking through creeks. I don't think they like to just necessarily fly with them left and right. So I think they like to roost where they can either pick this side or this side, depending on where the hens are at. And they like to get on them, you know, tall spots or something where they can hear multiple places or see a place and hear the other place. And I've seen it a lot of times, you know, if he's end up, he'll be kind of, you know, the hens will move on. He'll move on to an extent, but he'll stop and gobble and gobble and gobble and gobble, hoping you come to him. But he doesn't like, you know, he's three steps from losing eye contact with where he thinks you last were. And, you know, he's going to throw the kitchen sink at you instead of you throw the kitchen sink at him, trying to talk you into just at least trailing along so he can keep you and not have to burn these bridges. But, yeah, a lot of times I will see them come off a ridge, you know, roosting the top of a tree that's rooted in the bottom, and they'll pick one or the other. And then, I mean, that also gives them, I think they like to land in the ridges because it kind of catches them. And I've seen them land in the bottom like a daggum, you know, rail, airstrip. So
there was a time Jordan and I were hunting together. You'll remember this hunt. It was the COVID spring. And it was early. I mean, it may have been the third day of the season because I know we hunted this same place on the first day of the season. And we got this side of the turkey and the turkey pitched down and went that way. And we still didn't know like really good. We didn't know if the turkey was in the same spot. We didn't know exactly where he went. We just kind of know he went that way. And so we come in from the other side, and we're trying to get somewhat close, assuming he'd be in the same block of woods. And, like, in the moonlight, it was a bright, you know, full moon, Jordan spotted the track in the mud. You remember that?
Mm-mm.
It's the one – it was, like, the first one you killed that spring because we filmed the track in the mud. It's like we sat down in the turkey, like
– we're in Florida or Mississippi?
Mississippi.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The one – I mean, like – we sat down, and I don't even know if the turkey had gobbled yet, but it was early enough you would not think a turkey would fly down. We hadn't yelped at all. And like Jordan sat down, and I'm still trying to get the camera stuff ready, and I hear Jordan go, "Lake." And I look up, and it was bright enough where if you looked into the sky, it was light enough, and I just see this silhouette of a turkey just – he just landed like 40 yards out in front of us, and Jordan had to wait a few minutes because he couldn't see. I mean, that's how dark it was. But that ain't skill. We just got lucky that day.
I'd rather be lugging this guild a lot of days.
Yeah. Oh, that was like that one when I killed when I was 12, flew across that cutover, 200-something yards. I think I've told this story before.
That was one of the coolest things I've seen.
He coasted like this, 200 yards, stayed about that high over some cut, some eight-year-old pines, and dropped down from here to the bar. And boom, shot. I mean, thank goodness it was sage grass behind him, or I wouldn't have seen him, been able to see him. Yeah. I picked out a silhouette and shot him. That was like one minute after shooting light.
Might have killed the first turkey in Mississippi legally. Mm-hmm. Chase did when it was youth weekend. I'm telling you, it couldn't have been 120 seconds after shooting light started. I mean, almost you couldn't see the turkey. But sure enough, if it wouldn't have been just a little bit of a cloudy, backdrop, you're kind of sitting there watching me just getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger because I was kind of just sitting down behind you.
Mm. Oh, yeah, I forgot you were there.
Oh, I was there. And I went back the next morning. Pretty much the same thing happened, and I missed. First thing I ever missed. Yep, I was pretty pissed.
Yeah, we were last.
We don't have to talk about that.
Can't all be good.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, y'all got some more stuff. We're going to get into some live stuff, and then it's really to the wolves at that point.
Well, that bird also landed in 2 inches of water. Do you remember that?
Uh-uh.
Which was weird. He landed in, I mean, it was ankle-deep water right there, and he, like a duck would. It was odd. He just wanted to be there bad. It was a good bird.
Kosciuszko down the road.
Mm-hmm. So.
But that's all. I only picked a handful of stuff to premeditated, stuff that we got to get from our social media followers and stuff like that, folks we interact with and stuff. And there was a lot more than that, so we didn't get to apologize if you're here. Good opportunity to ask some live Q&A. Hope y'all, staying awake out there and everything. And I want to remind you, we're all going to be doing some giveaways, some memberships to ONX and a bunch of Mississippi State stuff, a bunch of Spring Legion stuff we're going to be giving out here shortly. So if you ain't got a raffle ticket, we'll have a little period before the end. Just run over there to see old Brick at the merch table and grab one of them tickets. And we're going to put them in a box or a bag or something and be pulling out. I don't know how many it winds up being, but 6, 8, 10, something kind of like that. So get you some free stuff before you go home tonight. And then following that, we'll be, hanging out and talking, shaking hands, stuff like that. But we'd like to get a couple live cues for the A's. If y'all got any, just raise your hand, and you might talk loud. But if we can see you, we'll see what you got.
What's our opinion on the turkey stamp they're looking to do?
Me knowing that there might be a turkey stamp means I know a little bit more than maybe everybody else right now, but I don't know a whole lot about it. I know a little bit. I talked to Adam Butler about it yesterday, I think. If Adam does what he says it's going to do, then it's a no-brainer. I mean, obviously, because the way it's supposed to work, I mean, there was an article. If you are interested in the turkey stamp, there's an article that was written in the Clarion Ledger that you can – I mean, I posted the link on my Instagram story today if you wanted to go and find it and read up about it. But it is meant to be, like, a very good thing. I mean, it would make it to where if you're going to turkey hunt here in this state, you're going to have to pay a little bit more money. But – if I have to pay a little bit more money and it's good for turkeys, then I'm going to pay a little bit more money. You know what I'm saying? So if the turkey stamp does what it's supposed to do, then I'm all for it.
Will we be able to kind of traject the number of turkey hunters in Mississippi by way of this with it not being a universal, everybody gets one?
Everyone is familiar with the duck stamp, or, you have a federal duck stamp and a state duck stamp. And so, they're not, even the biologists aren't going to say that this state duck stamp is a super accurate representation, like, to the number of how many waterfowl hunters are have, because there are a handful of folks that buy the stamp and never hunt. But it would give a way better gauge of what number we have than what we have right now. Because right now they can get it kind of close, but it's still speculating. If you make it where you have to buy a stamp, they could get a really good number.
And I'll speak on Adam Butler. He's a good dude. He's a turkey hunter. I mean, and to have him, kind of at the helm of anything that's going on with the department, we're very blessed. I've talked to a lot of folks across the country, and every single one of them says the same thing, that we are very lucky to have him kind of heading our stuff up. So anything he's got going on, I promise, is a good thing.
everything Adam does is science and research based, and that's what we need. So, yeah. Any more questions? Out-of-state trips plan. Y'all go first.
I'm going where the wind blows.
Yeah.
So we don't we travel with Hunter most of the time. We don't have any plans. We just load up and go.
Seals is the planner. He's the
– And I haven't planned anything this year.
Yeah.
I semi-planned something on the way here, but for South Florida, but I don't – we hadn't planned it for sure.
Yeah, we just try to tend to keep the truck loaded, and 90% of our trips happen about between 9 p.m. and 2 a.m. It's a text, get in the truck. Yeah. Here's a pen, or here's a state, or head north, and we'll meet up. So
send me some of them pens.
Mm-hmm.
I ain't got any.
Jordan and I got Florida next week. And then I know I'm taking my dad and my brother to Iowa. That was a whole story in its own.
Y'all going to Iowa?
Well, my brother killed his first turkey last spring, which that was fantastic. And then my dad missed a turkey last spring, which I guess I get it honest because Lord knows I've missed my fair share of turkeys. And then where else would we take? We're going to Texas because – I owe my wife because I took her to Texas last year and it was a disaster. Montana. I think that's all I got like dialed in. So yeah, I mean, yeah, fairly been there. I try to make spring like, I mean, I got some amount of trips nailed down, but I like to leave a little bit of variability in there so you can, you know, stay on your toes if you want to. But yeah, definitely got some planned out.
And I'm notorious flying by the seat of my pants, but this past spring I did learn the importance of weather, and I would try to get a route that was most efficiently timed, I guess you'd say, going here and going there and you know, trying to clip this, you know, little spot. You can get attacked at this half of the state and then attack in this half of the state. You don't have to, you know, travel, you know, too far. To hunt, you know, if you kill a turkey here, you're not far from another place that you're permitted to kill one. But hunting the weather is much more important than I would expect. I spent a long time, you know, multiple days in a region of the country that I had no business being in. I mean, season was open and birds were there to be killed, but I just really, you know, for lack of a better term, just pissing in the wind for 3 or 4 days and, you know, watching my buddies who went east instead of west or west instead of east, you know, being some, you know, pretty bluebird mornings and stuff like that. So I'm going to keep that in the back of my head as we kind of, you know, go on a whim the rest of this spring.
That it?
What's y'all's preferred cut on a mouth call?
Mine's a ghost cut. I can run majority of any ghost cut out there I've found, and I've dialed it in to one or two that I can really run. If I can kiki, yelp, tree call, and purr on one, that's one I'm going with. So
yeah. So I grew up running a true double piggyback style primos call. That's what I learned how to call on. And then
same here.
So the first couple of times I tried running a real mouth call, it sounds like what other folks try to do when they throw in the brick of a, you know, a true triple or something like that. Just, you know, just that thick. So it took me a while to figure out how to blow a real, you know, just a single, you know, layer of reeds like that. But I'm a bat wing guy. I can do some stuff on a ghost cut, but I get all the other stuff in there and I'm like, I don't know how the science works or the physiological air flow and stuff, but I know the ones that look like a bat wing, you know, I can blow those pretty good.
Yeah. I prefer a ghost cut myself. That's what I feel the most comfortable with.
I'm super cut dependent. Like if it's not a bat wing style cut, then it's going to sound terrible. It's just how I've always been envious of the guys that can blow all the different styles of cuts and make all, you know, but if it's not a bat wing, I can kiki really good on a ghost cut, which everybody can. So that's not saying anything, but yeah, it's gotta be a bat cutter. It's not really a preference. It's just I have to or I'll sound like hot garbage.
Yeah, one of the
biggest keys for me when I was trying to figure out what cut worked for me is figuring out where your air channel blows down your tongue. And there's several good videos on YouTube to help you figure that out. And you know, a lot of times, like calls or advertise, they'll do this or they'll do that, but honestly, it's all about how the person blows air and where that channel of air goes down your tongue. Some people it's left center, some people it's right center, some people it's right down the middle. And your ghost cut is right down the middle, of course, because that's where the cut is. Your bat wings, left or right center, and combo or reverse combo, you know, depending on which side that is may work better for you. For years, I tried everything in the books, and I mean, I could get by with it, but I never was confident in it. And finally, a couple of years ago, I started tinkering around blowing different types of ghost cuts and finally figured out some that worked best for me. But the cut thing on mouth calls is very, very much dependent on how you blow air down your tongue.
Yeah. The best thing that I would suggest is, like, go buy cheap versions of every cut style out there, and it won't take you long to figure out, like, this is the one that I do best with, and then hone in on that.
Yeah, go from there and buy different brands of that cut.
So. And I'm kind of like, I either sound kind of like a turkey or I sound like nothing. It don't even work, can't even crank it.
And, I mean, I have thrown in ghost cuts that I sound like hot garbage on. I mean, there is. I mean,
maybe you just ain't a good caller, Chase. I don't know.
I mean, I'm just – I got one. I picked – somebody handed me one at NWTF the other day, and I was like, thanks. Appreciate it. And I ran it, and it was rough. He ran one. He stretched 6 seconds for it, and, you know, his mouth ran it and ran the crap out of it. And everybody has a different structure, face structure, mouth structure, whatever you want to say. So if you can find one you do okay on, start honing in on that and buying. I mean, spend $100. You know, if you're that worried about it. If not,
if you start from zero, it's
run a slate till he gets in there, and if he's within earshot of, you know, sight of you, and you got to yelp twice, you can.
And I'll be the first to admit I do it a lot. If you're not good on a mouth call, don't try to be good on a mouth call in the turkey bullet. You know, practice in your truck, and then. There's several. If you get on a box call, use just the box call. I mean, if you weren't there, it would sound like a tree in there. I mean, you're trying to be nothing until you're trying to be like a turkey.
Right.
So silence definitely ain't going to mess it up. You ain't going to booger nothing by not saying nothing. You can only booger it if you're not confident in something, try to do something that you can't do that well, you know, until you're confident with it. I remember several times trying to, you know, use my mouth call because that's what, you know, the really good turkey hunters do. Right. They just use the mouth call. Well, I mean, I get a lot just from using, you know, a slate call or just from using a box call or whatever. And I've never really just bumped one by not doing anything at all. So just kind of blend in with your surroundings and, you know, just do what you're good at. And then worry about that when the time gets there. If you got to, you know, stop one with a mouth call, everybody can make a noise on it. You know, just blow hard, make a noise enough to make them stop. But you can get them in there without one at all if that's what it takes. You know, take your time and, you know, don't rush it.
Honestly, that can get on another rabbit hole there, but as far as, like, the wing bone with the mouth call goes stuff, like, you know, a lot of people sound pretty similar on a mouth call, and that's where I throw the wing bone in. But then, you know, I've struck up some turkeys with, like, the wing bone, and he'd be coming, and then, you know, I want to throw a mouth call in and yelp, and then I sound like every other hunter he's ever heard. Yeah. So, you know, sometimes it can throw a kink in the curve if you swap calls, actually. Now there's no knowing that beforehand till you find out the hard way. That's you can always try it, but sometimes it's gonna work, sometimes it's not. It all depends on the bird. So
that's true.
Does that cover that?
Pretty good.
All right.
Last call. We're gonna get into. All right.
Using a pot call. Hang on, you want to speak up just a little bit?
Pot call, different surfaces.
Oh, okay. Which one do we run?
I'm a glass guy.
Me too.
That's all I know. I know there's a bunch of different soundboard stuff that I don't really. I ain't gonna lie to you. It's got glass on it. And that's, you know.
Yeah.
I've used the same one for 20 years probably.
Yeah.
I would say, I mean, the pot Kyle style, that is straight up preference. That's like, now, in my vest, I'll have a, they call it a Pennsylvania slate and a you know, like the crystal kind. I'll have one of each because there's probably a reason why, but there's like some low pressure days. This one will carry further than the other one was. But, I mean, that's just preference. I mean, I like the Pennsylvania slate style the best, but, you know.
And I'm opposite of that. I primarily use a pot call for striking purposes only. I rarely ever use it when I'm sitting by a tree. But I have it's a crystal over aluminum soundboard on it, and I have a lot of confidence in it.
Calling's all preference, man.
And it's confidence, too.
Yeah. And we call all of them slate calls.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, it's all what you're confident is what you're going to sound good at. And, you know, silence never hurt. No. But and calling is so much timing, it's not even funny. You know, it's crazy how much better a turkey can hear than a human, and how there's a way to locate them with the calls, which is one thing, and there's a way to talk like a turkey is another thing. And then if you're where a turkey would usually be on a day given the circumstances, and you make a turkey sound, a lot of times that's all you got to do. Once he knows you're there, he knows you're there, and you're just kind of talking him into coming to a place he's already coming. Kind of, you know, I've opened a Pandora's box for botching that hunt way more than I have, you know, really solidifying him coming in to check it out.
How'd it work?
Good.
Any more before we start raffling things? Once, twice.
All right.
So.
Well, good deal. Want to tell y'all how much we appreciate y'all coming out. We are going to be wrapping the audio version on this up. This will be coming out in a day or two. We're going to have to do some mixing and meshing of these two audio things. We ain't the most tech-savvy folks, so we're going to have to blend a couple of these little these cards here and the audios and make a podcast out of it. But I want to appreciate y'all supporting us. Hey, that's a big you know, a big thank you for that, just the showing up, and then just for being turkey hunters and good stewards of the bird. And I think that'll wrap it up. I want to thank Rick's again. Just, I mean, seriously, this is a really cool opportunity, one that we've grown to look forward to every year, where, you know, us as a group can get up here and talk turkey and shake hands with some familiar faces. And that's when you know, it ain't going to be long now when we're sitting up here. And I really appreciate it. And really appreciate these gentlemen next to me for coming on up here and hopping on. So we good? Appreciate everything. Thanks for listening to the Spring Ledge Podcast. We'll see you next week.